Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting individual, Wyn Baptiste, who's currently the producer of a youth TV drama called MTV Sugar. He's currently producing a mini spin-off series based around COVID-19 and the lockdown. He's also developing a documentary about the Grenfell Tower disaster. And as part of the process, has already made a mini offshoot film to mark the first anniversary. He was the presenter, producer, director of a BBC social history documentary about the origins and cultural significance of the Notting Hill Carnival. Previously, he's produced a whole range of short campaign films for a range of politicians, NGOs, pressure groups, and brands. Before that, he was a journalist with the BBC for 10 years, as a reporter, producer and news editor at BBC London, and also editor of the Community Affairs Unit with a specialism in portraying diversity on air. He's also, prior to that, been a producer-director with The Economist's Intelligence Unit, and was also a director at the Africa Channel. So all absolutely dynamic stuff. So, Wyn, how are you?
Sean, great to hear your voice and to link up with you. Thank you very much for inviting me to join you. I'm okay, a little bit lockdown frazzled, like many, but I'm good. Thank you.
Very good indeed. You say you're lockdown frazzled because you're lockdown frazzled with a two-year-old. I feel your pain.
That's it. Parenting in lockdown has its own particular challenges. For me, lockdown has been actually a really, really busy time. And you know, we'll talk a little bit about the work I've been doing, which is kind of been connected to lockdown and COVID-19. So it's been a really, really busy time. But I think you know, just for so many of us, it's been about adjusting. And I think that people have had, you know, very different experiences of lockdown and different challenges. But it's certainly a new abnormal, as the title of your podcast suggests. And it's all about, I think, you know, continually adjusting to the new way of working. And then, you know, preparing and rolling with the punches for what may lie on the other side.
Yeah, totally. Well, to start off somewhere, and obviously we've got such a huge amount to talk about. Just to sort of set the scene, perhaps it'd be really good just take us through. So, how you got going, and then it would be great, perhaps just almost like in order of stuff. Just then talk about the carnival, your dad, the mighty Sir Wyn Baptiste, the history of all of that, and then we'll sort of just come up to the sort of present day. So, yeah, starting first of all with sort of your background, and then in particular carnival and the background around that and the area, etc.
Well, I was born and bred in London, in Notting Hill. My professional career started really as me training as a journalist, and specifically as a radio journalist. And so, broadcast journalism was the starting point of my career as a radio reporter and newsreader and producer. I worked for a variety of independent radio stations before joining Choice FM, which was a black music station based in the heart of Brixton. This is the early 1990s, and I was part of the news team there. And, you know, I've been thinking back to those times a lot in the past few weeks, as you might imagine. You know, thinking back to the sorts of stories and issues we were bringing to the airwaves in a small but impactful way. And sadly, Choice FM is no more, but it was a real kind of pioneer in bringing music and views and voices to the airwaves that really were not being heard. And it was from there that I went to join the BBC, firstly joining as a journalist in what was called a community affairs unit. Community affairs was BBC speak in those days for black and ethnic minority issues. And, you know, it was a laudable initiative to try and strengthen the way the BBC was portraying diverse communities on air, but also at the same time being a gateway for people from different backgrounds, you know, a portal into the organization. And you know, as a reporter, I had, you know, some specific briefs at that time. It wasn't limited to this, but, you know, some of the notable things that were kind of on my reporting beat were deaths in custody at that time, which, you know, clearly is in everybody's minds at the moment. And you know, so I've cast my mind back to that time, you know, a lot in the last few weeks, you know, covering the cases of people like Roger Silvestro, who's a man who died in custody in Tottenham, Christopher Alder in Hull, and just so many of kind of the issues that that those, you know, devastating cases brought up, of course, you know, are echoed all these years later with what we've been considering and witnessing over the past few weeks. One of the notable things at Choice FM, notable moment was I did a phone in with the Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Paul Condon.
Oh yeah.
And it took place in what some people would describe as the belly of the beast. We actually did the broadcast from Scotland Yard, and you know, and it was quite something, him, you know, taking calls directly from the community about concerns around how black communities were being policed. And you know, I've got to say, I did you know, I respected him for having the openness to do that and to speak to people face to face like that. And, you know, I think that in terms of policing in London, over the years, that, you know, there have been strides forward, but there are still difficulties. So I think it's important to acknowledge the strides forward. You know, one of the key points in that was, you know, and this was something else that I reported on closely, was the death of the murder of Stephen Lawrence, teenager, 18-year-old, stabbed to death by a gang of white racists in southeast London, and the subsequent public inquiry into all the matters surrounding his death. And I think something that was significant that hasn't, you know, cured everything, but was certainly a big stepping stone, was that inquiry concluded that the police force was institutionally racist. Now, interestingly, in the States, in the wake of George Floyd's killing, the authorities there were very, very, very quick to be categorical and say that the police forces in the United States are not institutionally racist. And it just really struck me. It really hit me like a hammer, like, wow, that is really setting out the kind of organizational and policy battle lines here that here in the UK, the Stephen Lawrence inquiry kind of broke through. But, you know, I wouldn't put rose tinted spectacles on and say, you know, everything's okay over here. It's not. And the ripple effects of the the George Floyd protests have hit over here, because there are societal issues that really need to be addressed. Then at the BBC, I went on to be in charge of news output for BBC London. And after spending 10 years there, I cut ties with the apron strings of Auntie. It can be quite difficult when you're part of a big organization and a huge media organization like the BBC to then strike out as a freelance. It's deep breath time, and just changed direction slightly and went much more into film, making a lot of campaign films, making some and doing documentary work. And the campaign film stuff was quite interesting because I needed to kind of reset some of my thinking, because journalism was all about gathering the facts, balancing it out, and then presenting it. And campaign films is much more about delivering a message. I needed to kind of just re-educate and just reset my thinking. And so, did quite a lot of work for some, leading politicians and various campaigns. Before making my first, TV documentary, which was the one that you referred to, around the Notting Hill Carnival. And it was, that was a particular kind of passion project because it really focused down on the story of my father, who was a Trinidadian musician, steel pan player, who came to this country in 1960 and was directly involved in the early years of the Notting Hill Carnival. And so this film, Notting Hill Carnival, who started it, was really, it's kind of a personal journey for me. Working with family has its pluses and minuses. And my father was, was quite a character, and he would have liked being producer and director and all of that stuff. We worked hand in hand on it. And, like many documentary projects, actually, you hear it a lot. It took a long time to do. And actually, he died before it was finished. And it was actually at his funeral that the project really got a new energy, because, we had this huge funeral in Notting Hill, and so many people said, this is an important bit of work that you've got to get done, even though he's gone. And so it was a cathartic experience. But I think that, beyond it being a family story for me, it was something about the cultural landscape of Britain, really, from the 1960s to today, because the Notting Hill Carnival has been a kind of a landmark, kind of physically, in terms of its nature and its geography, in this particular quite remarkable part of London, but also something about, black people in this city over the past 50 years. Slightly controversial within the carnival community, because people can't agree what year the first one really was, and there's various kind of differing views on the history. What I found is that history is in the eye of the beholder, and people can be at the same event or same happening and have a slightly different perspective on it, or a slightly different memory of what happened, or will put a different accent on it. And so for me, in that documentary, there were three audiences. There was the BBC audience, there was the carnival community, black community audience, and then it was my family. And the one I was most kind of worried about, in a way, was the carnival community, because I wanted to do justice to their reality and their truth. The only way to do that, really, was to speak to a wide range of people who may have had slightly differing takes, but for them, their truth was their truth, and to portray that faithfully. And I can still walk down Labrick Grove without people shouting at me or throwing things at me. So that has to be some modicum of success around that. And which kind of led on in many ways to my involvement in doing film work around the Grenfell Tower tragedy, which of course happened in the very same neighborhood. The most devastating event, this tower block fire that claimed 72 lives and is a story that starts well before the fire. It's a story about speaking to power. It's a story about how we are governed. It's a story of community resilience before and in the aftermath. And it's a story about truth and justice. So that work is ongoing. As we speak, the third anniversary is just days away.
And 14th, isn't it?
Yes, indeed, the 14th of June. And, there are lots of aspects to the question of justice around this most dreadful of events. But one of the most clear and present things for us all to think about is there are 300 buildings in this country still covered in the cladding, which has been shown to have accelerated this awful fire. And, it's scandalous and it's scandalous that it was used. And, the inquiry is, the second phase of the inquiry is due to start. But the second phase of the inquiry will look at factors beyond what happened on the night, and the contributing factors around how decisions are made. And that is going to be absolutely key. And just think that today there are 300 buildings in this country with that cladding still on the outside. That's 23,000 homes. That's 23,000 households that go to bed tonight knowing that that material is on the outside of their building.
Whoa. Bloody hell. Yeah, absolutely incredible.
And then I suppose just the, and so the latest, part of my CV that you so kindly outlined at the beginning of this podcast is I made the move from documentary, factual and documentary, into drama, and I work on a show called MTV Sugar. It is a drama aimed at young people. The action has been based in Kenya, in Nigeria, South Africa, most latterly Côte d'Ivoire, and we did a version of the show in India. And I don't really like this term, but it gets used. It's edutainment. So it's drama with a message. Mm-hmm. And so the MTV Staying Alive Foundation, which is the social responsibility arm of that broadcast organization, started 21 years ago. Its bedrock is HIV awareness. And it started at that time when the AIDS epidemic was at its height and stigma was at its most vicious. Yeah. And the kickoff was a documentary that was fronted by George Michael to try and cut through some of the horrendous narrative, prejudicial narrative around HIV. And then over the year, 10 years ago, this drama started, MTV Sugar, that has, it's entertainment, it harnesses the MTV brand. There is, close links to music, but with a message around HIV awareness, young people and their sexual health, relationships, and more latterly, broadening its remit to take in questions like gender-based violence and equality in education. But all in a way that is not about preaching. It's not about setting out any rules. And indeed, every season starts and finishes with young people. Their views and attitudes are taken into character development, script development, and storylines, and it's evaluated by young people along the way. And the drama becomes part of a campaign each season. And just to give you kind of the evaluation side of things, the World Bank did an evaluation of MTV Sugar and found that out of the audience, when young people watch it, they're twice as likely to get an HIV test.
Wow.
Chlamydia rates drop dramatically. Reporting of, you know, impact on gender-based violence. And so there's also an academic side. Now, I am not an academic. I'm a journalist, producer, filmmaker, storyteller type person. But the academic side of it is evaluation and application of something you're probably aware of called a theory of behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, runs through everything that we do. It's about trying to identify a need, speaking to that need with authentic storytelling, and then evaluating its impact on the other side. Which brings us up to what's happening right now. You know, for production, for television and film production, lockdown has meant lockdown. And we wanted to find a way of how we could be relevant during the pandemic, and how we could practically do anything. And so we have launched something called MTV Sugar Alone Together. And all the characters, the premise is that the characters are all communicating via video call. And so we, and across all the territories that we operate in. And it's been a challenging and really fun proposition, because you're confined to just that kind of square on the screen, you know, that we've all got so used to communicating via during lockdown. And each episode becomes really like a play, because part of what you're doing is having to paint a picture for the audience of what they can't see. And it's very much about the performance and the writing, as, you know, all television drama is. But, you know, because it's so focused on each individual, that becomes the knack and the art of it, really. And so it's short episodes, 6, 7, 8 minute episodes that drop every day. And we're on episode 31, and we've got another 30 to go. So it's been full on, but it's been, and so the idea is to, you know, reflect people's realities in lockdown, do some kind of public health messaging around staying safe, but also looking into related issues that, you know, sadly, domestic violence spikes everywhere during lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
But also some lighter sides about, you know, how do you date and how do you navigate relationships, and how about communicating with those family members you haven't spoken to for years, but suddenly now you're on lockdown, you're talking to everybody, and, you know, putting having a light spin on some of that stuff. So I've talked at you for quite a few minutes there, but that's kind of my career to now and what I'm doing today.
Nice. No, absolutely. I mean, just fascinating stuff and just important stuff and interesting and all the rest of it. I mean, just a hugely an admirer of that. Just to perhaps sort of, you know, look at, you know, just one of many of the great issues there. So you're talking earlier about, you know, history being in the eye of the beholder, particularly, let's say, with regards to in the context of the carnival film, and, you know, that point about, you know, two people might be at the same event and come away with a completely different understanding of what just happened or whatever, and difficult even to pin down things like when did the carnival actually get going. So I watched that film again prior to this, and it's just really interesting, that point about sort of cultural history. And, you know, a lot of those people obviously who have blue plaques up about them on the walls around Ladbroke Grove and all the rest of it, you know, Ronnie Laslett and Claudia Jones and Russell Henderson. One of the points you made in that film was also talking about your dad, Selwyn. So what happened? So has he got his blue plaque?
So what they did was, and I think it was a very good compromise, because really the truth is something like Notting Hill Carnival is not down to one person. You know, there's the, you know, the original old school Russell Henderson trio, steel band players who had a steel pan around their neck that went on a little walk around the block on that very first one. And then people like Leslie Palmer, who came in the early 70s and really oversaw the thing scaling up with sound system coming in and it becoming more than a Trinidadian cultural event, but much more about federating the different West Indian islands and cultures that had, that had come together in one, you know, in one place. You know, of course, you got black communities all over London, but you know, Brixton and Notting Hill were two of the key kind of focal points for community. And so in terms of the blue plaque, what they got to was they decided to make a huge one. I mean, it must have weighed a ton, with names of, I think, 50 pioneers. And it felt like a really good way to go, because, you know, arguments about who should go up next and why isn't so-and-so on there can prevail. And people might, you know, listen to this and wonder, well, why is that important? Well, I think it's just understanding what this event is. For people who don't know, who haven't been, the Notting Hill Carnival is an event that happens at the end of August every year in Notting Hill, this little corner of West London. And, you know, a million or more people take to the streets, and it's a celebration of traditional carnival culture that originated in Trinidad from steel bands and mass bands and calypso music, but has developed into really a reflection of multicultural Britain in terms of music that an expression, really. But in those early days, it was something about ownership and identity and being able to have free abandon and control of something on an annual basis, at a time when, you know, I think we're looking at, you know, at this moment in time, we're looking at a lot of stuff to do with structural racism that is having a detrimental impact on ethnic minority communities, whether it be, you know, housing, employment, economic empowerment, the way that they're policed and opportunity. But in those days, it was overt and in your face. You know, it sounds like a cliche now, but the, you know, no dogs, no Irish, no black sign, you know, in the window of rented accommodation was a thing. You know, overt racism and police harassment and brutality was the absolute norm in this country. And so this was more than a chance to dance, enjoy music, and have a drink. It was something more than that. It was a statement about we're here, and also making a contribution and a mark on the cultural landscape. You know, beyond the party, you know, things came to a head in 1976 when there was a serious riot, where the youth, having been faced with police harassment all year round and huge, swamping, heavy policing of the event, things came to a head and there was a face-off and there was serious disorder. But sometimes it's a powder keg moment that has to happen. And, you know, it wasn't long after that that the First Race Relations Act came into place, and you can't help but think that that must have had some sort of impact on government about, you know what, we need to look at something here. Now, that didn't solve everything, but it was a step. It was a step forward. But, you know, there was some made me laugh. I did hear one quote from one local resident. When Carnival started, they thought it was a protest march. And and of course, you know, it wasn't a protest march, but in a way it was.
Yeah.
If you look at the origins of Carnival in Trinidad, you know, playing mass, masquerading was all about, it was all about sticking two fingers up to the former slave masters. It was about celebrating emancipation. It was about poking fun at those who had literally held the whip hand.
Yeah.
So long. And so the Carnival is about joy and expression, but it's also rooted in being and politics with a small p, and the right to be.
Yeah. Well, and then up to the present day then, so that's 76. And actually, just get back slightly before that again, before we came up to the present day. So, I mean, again, in that film that you made, which again, I watched again recently, and there's a bit, I think, when you go down to see Ishmael Blagrove, the documentary photographer, and you're looking through lots of old shots on the wall, again, of people like sort of Ronnie Lazlett and all the rest of it. And then there's a shot of your dad sitting on some steps somewhere down Labatt Grove or wherever, or one of the sort of side streets. And then there's also just bits of old documentary footage of, you know, the late 50s, the race riots, the conditions in the whole Notting Hill area, and, you know, around Ladbroke Grove. Just, again, now you just can't almost believe what you're seeing. You look back just to how bad conditions were in those days. I mean, set amongst, I mean, I remember all the old Colin McInnes books, you know, Absolute Beginners and Mr. Love and Justice, that talked about the conditions at the time. But it just seems, astonishing to see just how appalling the conditions were in those days.
Yeah, that photograph of him is, that's a brilliant shot. He looks absolutely knackered. That was at the end of the day when the riots kicked off, actually, in 76. And, he looks like he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, but yeah.
And there's a great poster, can I say, next to him, that Black Liberation Front poster on the wall next to him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so there'd been race riots in 58, clashes between Teddy Boys and Mob Youth, and then there was notorious racist murder of Kelso Cochran in Ladbroke Grove, which again was a key moment and got the attention really about just how serious these tensions could be and how serious outcomes could be. And then in terms of kind of conditions down there, it's funny that, you know, most people from around the world, if you say Notting Hill, they think about the Julia Roberts film.
Yeah.
Which caused some controversy in the community, really, because it felt that it kind of it had the moniker Notting Hill, but didn't show the whole of Notting Hill, and it showed an aspect of it. But conditions in the 60s were rough, you know, really, really rough, and you know, my dad's way into the story really was that. But he was a champion steel pan player from Trinidad. He came to London to study music, but when he got here, there were, you know, the realities of the difficulties facing young people, you know, and the conditions they were living under really, as he said to me, just pricked his conscience really. And his contribution was to use the steel pan to try and bring some cohesion. And at that time there were things called adventure playgrounds, which were basically play resources that were converted for local young people on bomb sites, Second World War bomb sites that had never been built up again. And the Notting Hill Adventure Playground was a place where he taught steel band to kids, and not just to black kids, but kids from all backgrounds. And the idea was to use music and use activity to try and bring people together and give a bit of direction. And and it was a key part of the origin of Carnival, with his steel band, the Metronome steel band, being put together by the boys that learnt the pan in the playground and became one of the first bands on the road. But it was about using an art form for social and cultural good. And you know, he had no plan to do that when he came here, but kind of fell into it. And I often thought, you know, what must he think when we'd be walking around there and there'd be a million people on the streets and thinking about those humble beginnings. Quite something. And this year cancelled for the first time ever in 50 years due to coronavirus, which was a sad but right decision, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so then coming again to talking about sort of present day. So one of the things that I've been talking about with all the other sort of people that have been on the sort of in the various podcasts has been, you know, one of the topics has been this issue of the sort of battle of the narratives. And one of the issues around battle of the narratives has been put in, or one of the contexts has been the issue around, fake news, disinformation, misinformation, and all the rest of it, you know, alternative facts. Now, and again, over the last week, you know, what have we seen here? You know, statues of Colston being, you know, thrown off bridges in Bristol. Obviously, we've seen the hideous murder of George Floyd in the US. Black Lives Matter has become absolutely center stage, you know, front page of every newspaper and sort of news report, as it should. I mean, from the point of view of, I mean, so your story, so going, you know, almost like linking that to, so they were at Choice FM, you know, bluntly put, black radio station based out of Brixton, what, 25 years ago, when that was almost, you know, compartmentalized in that way in terms of the greater sort of or bigger media narrative. Just talk me through the issues you see it now, as you witness it again, being ex-BBC as well, in terms of the amount of honest and or not reporting, fake news around this whole story, wild exaggeration or not. So just in terms of how the narrative is being played out in a world that on one hand has, you know, the Guardian and the BBC and the Washington Post, but the other side has Fox News.
Well, I think that I think conspiracy theories are interesting. I mean, they have been a plethora of such, you know, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, and you know, China made it on purpose. 5G, certainly with, you know, the work that I've done in Africa, you know, I'd heard narratives from people that, you know, quickly dispelled. Black people can't get it. It's a white man's disease. And the vaccination question is really an interesting one too, because there is, you know, there are the, you know, there's the pre-COVID kind of anti-vax movement, but I think the skepticism around vaccination is something real, and probably growing, because, you know, the question is, you know, people don't quite know what to believe, and I think just on the vaccination point, there's a guy called Peter Piot, who is the director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And he's been an advisor and a kind of mentor around MTV Sugar, because he's an expert on infectious diseases. He's given his life to kind of HIV AIDS. He was one of the people who in 1976 discovered the Ebola virus. And he's the dad of one of my colleagues. And the reason I bring him up is that, you know, here we have world expert on viruses and infectious diseases, and he contracted COVID-19, and nearly died, was in a London hospital. He wrote you know, a fantastic piece on that. You know, can you imagine, you know, what sort of headspace he would have been in, thinking he'd given his life to combating viruses, and one was about to get him. You know, but the reason I bring it up particularly is that, you know, he's adamant that the only way out of this pandemic properly, you know, lies in finding the vaccination, and crucially, it being administered widely. But he also acknowledges that, you know, there is a skepticism around taking the vaccine because of a narrative around it being part of a conspiracy, or, you know, why would you introduce something on the face of it that looks harmful to your children and what have you. So I think, you know, when a vaccine comes up, there'll be an interesting battle to win confidence. This is the thing to do. So that's kind of, you know, I think that's going to be a really interesting narrative about where does the truth lie around vaccines and you know, fake conspiracy theories and founded worries that people might have. But, you know, a top expert saying this is going to be the way out for
us. Yeah, yeah.
In terms of kind of, you know, other narratives, I think, you know, the reporting of Black Lives Matter stuff, you know, I would say that on the whole, the reporting that I've seen has been good, but I think it's very, very interesting to look at the narrative when things boil over. You know, putting the US to one side for a moment and just looking at the UK, you know, statues being toppled, cool symptoms, statue being pulled down, you know, and thrown into the harbour in Bristol. That, you know, I would argue that isn't just a flashpoint bit of wanton vandalism. People have been campaigning for a long time to have that statue taken down. Very predictably, you know, politicians will say, you know, we cannot condone this, people should be found and prosecuted and what have you, but you know what, sometimes some radical action needs to be taken to make a change. Interestingly, now councils all over the country are doing an audit of the statues that they've got, and they're having a debate about what people want.
Yeah.
Now, there's also, you know, I was having a debate with my friends. People were saying, you know, some saying we need to fish that out and put it in a museum so that it's a reminder of the slave trading past. And I think that looks like that's what's going to happen. But if it's going to go into a museum, it also needs to have an installation that shows the video of it being pulled down, that has the whole narrative of, you know, the city of Bristol being built on the slave trade and the, you know, and the Industrial Revolution being, you know, supported by it and sugar and all the rest of it. Because I don't know about you, Sean, but when I was at school, that was not taught.
No, not at all.
Not at all. And so, you know, so the death of George Floyd will hopefully have an impact on, you know, some fundamental stuff about education and the curriculum and the narrative and the truth that can hopefully find some peace for people and help people move forward can help engender true equality. Because I think for too long, when people have try to bring these stories to the fore, it sounds like you've got a chip on your shoulder. I'll stop it with all that slave trade stuff. All reparation to Africa. You know, do me a favor. Everything's fine. But actually, you know what? This stuff needs to be acknowledged so that we can move forward in a more fulsome way, in my view. So, putting that statue is actually quite significant, I would argue. But going back to kind of coverage of when protests boil over, you know, I wouldn't condone violence or destruction, right? But at the same time, you know, anger sometimes needs an outlet. There will be some people that may be opportunistic around something like that, but at the end of the day, it's the anger is righteous. But if you know, to answer your question, if you look at coverage, there've been quite a lot of violent Tommy Robinson demos over the last couple of years, and I've been really surprised at how low key the coverage of that has been, and what the language around that has been, even in enlightened media.
Yeah,
but when it's kind of black youth doing something, the language kind of changes, and I think that it's kind of important to look at that. You know, looking at a completely different situation, but if you look at terrorism, too often, if a white person goes on, you know, a gun rampage, they're labeled as being kind of unhinged and a bit mad, but the terrorist label isn't put on them. And you've got to ask yourself the question, why?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, was it a couple of years ago, wasn't it, that the guy in Las Vegas that just killed, you know, murdered of just a huge number of people. And yeah, that was, I think, rather portrayed as being, you know, had a slight problem, so, you know, brush it over. And then obviously the other guy that blew up the government building in wherever, Oklahoma, the sort of white supremacist gang or whatever.
I tell you what, in terms of a beacon country for how they handle stuff, I think we need to look at New Zealand. You know, you can argue that, okay, it's maybe governing New Zealand is slightly less complex than the US or Britain. Maybe it's you know, you're not dealing with such a big economy, whatever. Me, it doesn't matter. It's about principles. And I've just been, one, just really impressed by the leadership of Jacinda Ardern. You know, they get a white supremacist madman going on the rampage. And the way her, you know, the leadership around that and the response to it was spot on, and it was about bringing that country together. But more broadly, New Zealand is a country that has turned to the happiness index rather than GDP
being
the measure or the value of the success of a society and how it's governed. And I think that, you know, I think there really is something in that, in terms of, because, you know, the happiness index looks at the well-being of citizens rather than the economic bottom line. Metrics are around psychological health, living standards, community vitality, and the cultural resilience, and that's the sorts of things that they will then pull on to dictate policy rather than it just being economic. And I think that, you know, post-COVID, there just may be a chance to reset how we're governed and how we value, you know, what the values in society are. Now, you know, that may say that, you know, perhaps I'm naive and a bit too optimistic, but I do have a hope that, because a lot of stuff has had to have been pared back to basic because of this situation, there is a chance that we can reset how we value the structures in society.
It's interesting, and I think about the happiness index, I think it's Bhutan, wasn't it? They were the first ones that trialed it, and it's been what a glorious beacon of hope it is to have that as a sort of the way that one judges or underlines a society. What about just taking that point forward? So again, a lot of the conversations during this sort of series have been about looking at things through the prism of commerce, through brands, marketing, advertising, etc. One of the key points that one of the better sort of articles over the last week in the marketing press about the impact of Black Lives Matter was just talking about the amount of absolute self-serving, self-glorifying crap that brands came out with in terms of just coming out with statements, basically said, Black Lives Matter logo, which obviously achieves absolutely zero, but makes the brand feel slightly better about itself. There's an interesting piece in the Times just saying, actually, no, you know what? Don't do any of that. Actually, if you want to do something actionable. And the easiest and clearest way of doing that for any corporate is to ensure that in every single department, without fail, there are opportunities given on an equal basis for people of color. And the clearest indication of that is just to say, show us a photograph of your board and we'll just basically be able to judge ourselves who's actually on that board. Just wanted your take on that from the point of view of there have been lots and lots of brand statements over the last week. I mean, have any of them actually impressed you? Has anyone been out there on a corporate level doing something that you have felt was doing things in the right way, or what?
Well, I think firstly, if it's superficial, it'll be seen through. The policy U-turn from the American football folks, the NFL, around taking them through, ludicrous. So there's a great example of how people would just like see through that, and it won't be enough. What I'd suggest for them is that they need to do a root and branch, look at themselves as an organization. A little bit of humility would have gone a long way around that, rather than it being kind of being blown along with the wind, shall we say. People see through that stuff. Brilliant one from a UK perspective. I don't know if you saw that those tweets from Yorkshire Tea. I think it was it Tweeting Tips this week. There was some,
I haven't seen it,
some Twitter spat from some woman's but saying something about, I think the starting point was, how ridiculous it was to talk about, the slave trade and the tea, the history of tea and sugar and what have you. And Yorkshire Tea just came back and said, please don't buy our tea anymore, Black Lives Matter, which was not thought of in a kind of, campaign, brainstorm, impacted on me because it felt real. Genuine. And I think that thing about boardrooms and opportunities, I think that this is an opportunity and indeed a duty for every organization to look at themselves through the prism of structural racism. There's a thing called there's unintended racist outcomes that come from just the way the corporate world has been built. I've kind of repeated, plagiarized this line a few times, of late, but it's because it's true. The system ain't broken. It was built this way. And so we need to look at how it was built. And so opportunity is absolutely right. But I think it's about a presence at every level. So opportunities at entry level, but also just having different voices at the table, at decision making level, I think the voices need to be heard from every level. Clearly, you can't run every company or organization by committee or as a democracy. But it's about having input from slightly different perspectives that is going to help organizations change in a meaningful way. Window dressing and lip service can ultimately be more damaging and counterproductive. So Yorkshire Tea get it for me and their Twitter feed. Just rewinding also just to kind of news coverage thing. I think that George Floyd's is not the is it is sadly only one in a long list of shame of, you know, of such cases. And indeed, you know, there's a history of such cases here. I think what's interesting is, if you think about it, there has been nothing else on the news agenda but coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the story that broke through. And so the eyes of the world were on the story that took coronavirus off the top billing. And so there's something about that, I think, you know, that's not to say the whole thing's driven by media. Of course it's not. It's the reaction of people on the ground and what have you. But I think there's something in that, that, you know, the global eyes really focused in. And so that's not the whole thing by any point. But, you know, as we're talking about media specifically, that's an interesting thing to consider.
Mm. Okay. And that took just the last few minutes, and it's been absolutely brilliant. And thanks so much for giving me some of your time. What about activism, should we say, just, you know, in general, in terms of portraying it, documentaries about it, bringing contemporary activism to life? I know you're up to many interesting things. Anything you can say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's I can't say too much about this, but but I'm in some early development on a show actually that we started doing some work on, you know, before coronavirus, before George Floyd's sad killing, you know, around activism, looking at a show that would have some strong elements around that, because, you know, this is a renewed age of activism. You know, it wasn't that long ago that we felt that politics was just anodyne, and what did people believe in anymore? And, you know, political parties are all the same. People argue that they always have been and always will be. But, you know, that there was kind of an apathy. And over the last few years, that's changed, in my opinion. And you know, around affecting change, I think it is largely about individuals mobilizing and becoming groups at a very local level. And if you look at Black Lives Matter, it's, you know, something at a local level that's gone global. If you look at the stuff around Grenfell Tower, you know, it's ordinary people who have been thrust into extraordinary circumstances. Have become tireless campaigners and advocates demanding change, finding ways and means to speak to power. And there will be small victories and a lot of knockbacks. But, you know, that kind of community mobilization, I think, is where people will see where you can feel in a position of powerlessness, but where power actually might lie once a coalition of the like-minded become effective. You know, we've got people, you know, around the communities affected by Grenfell that have become experts on housing policy and, you know, ins and outs of cladding and what have you. You know, people who were thrust into having face-to-face meetings with the Prime Minister behind the door of number 10 and bringing their truth there. Now, how effective they've been, you know, it's been thus far, you know, is arguable, but there have been small victories, and, you know, the foot will not come off the pedal. If you look at, if you look at the Hillsborough campaigners, you know, it took them 30 years to get to an inquest result that they felt was fair, but then they got a step back when the first criminal prosecution failed. Now, some people like the Grenfell campaigners, you know, speak directly to Hillsborough and can learn from their journey of activism, and hopefully it won't take 80 years to get a result. But I do think mobilizing on a local level is a thing, and people are prepared to stand up. And I think that, you know, change will be down to leadership, but you know, I think leadership will political leadership will need to listen to groups like that who are organized and relentless. But I think with all campaigns for change, you've got to break out of an echo chamber. It's no good if everybody's just like-minded speaking to themselves. So it's about taking things to the next level. So you can look at Grenfell, you can look at Black Lives Matter, you can look at what, you know, Greta Thunberg did with her school boycott that became something else. You can look at Malala, you know, the Pakistani girl who was shot by the Taliban and addressed the UN. So, you know, activism can have impact. And but I think, you know, I would hope that in terms of British politics, it's hard to say. I did have some, I'm on the fence about how things might change on the other side of this. It may or it may not. As I said, I think earlier, I think, you know, stripping back people to the bare bones, I think, you know, the population can think about what is most important. It would seem to me that the National Health Service, you know, is it now untouchable or not? You know, with the claps on the doorsteps every week, with, you know, the respect that the people within the National Health Service have, and the spotlight that's been on them, and the scandalous kind of disregard there has been in, you know, the care sector, you know, how is the government going to deal with financial holes on the other side of this? It seemed to me that austerity, the policy of austerity, has been dealt a blow. What's going to happen on the other side? It'll be really interesting to know. A bit of humility would go a long way. You know, if mistakes have been made through this coronavirus thing, it needs to be owned. I wonder if that could change. The thing is, though, you know, nothing might change. And, you know, it seems that populist-based voter bases kind of seem unmoved by events. It seems to be that kind of base is linked to an idea rather than results. But who knows? I'm hoping there can be some positive change in governance on the other side of this. But I guess we wouldn't hold our breath.
Yeah, well, there we are. Should we say, on that note, I think we're just about there time-wise, Wings. I know you also had to move on. But look, that is absolutely fascinating. I thought everything you were saying there was incredibly interesting. So, reporter, producer, editor, director, journalist, documentary maker, Wyn Baptiste, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.